Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some strange way. And today, I'm real excited to have writer, director Jen McGowan with me. Hi, Jen.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I have to tell you, though, I don't really write.
You don't really write?
I don't.
You would think just because you're so prolific in the public.
Yeah, well, I have a big mouth, but I try to resist writing at all for all possibilities.
That's actually a good thing to talk about. We are going to get into that with Jonathan Glazer and the role of the director if they're not
writing
too, which is a whole other thing.
Well, that's the work that I love.
All right. So let's put a pin in it.
Okay.
And I'm going to give everyone a quick background on Jen's work. So Jen got her start with award-winning short films, Confessions of a Late Bloomer and Touch, which played at over 100 festivals worldwide. Throughout that time, she was also working as a production manager and second unit or assistant director on projects. But in 2014, Jen made her feature directorial debut with Kelly and Cal, starring Juliette Lewis and Sybil Shepherd, which premiered at South by Southwest, where she won the Game Changer Award. The film tells the story of a suburban mom who longs for her old punk rock life and the boy she meets who's just now trying to find his way into the world. That film was released theatrically by IFC Films to rave reviews. In addition to her directing work, however, Jen's also the creator of FilmPower.com, an international skill sharing, networking, and jobs resource for professional women in film and television. Take the Lead Foundation identified McGowan as one of 50 women who will change the world in media and entertainment, and We for She selected her for the 2019 Direct Her program. A Film Independent Fellow, finalist for the Clint Eastwood Filmmakers Award, recipient of the AWD Breakout Award for Excellence in Directing. She was named one of Vulture's women directors Hollywood should be hiring. Her current feature film, the survival thriller Rust Creek, which tells the story of a woman who fights to escape abduction in the woods only to find allies in unlikely places, is now going to be released in theaters January 2019 by IFC Midnight. Her TV series, Angelica, about the last remaining abortion clinic in a small Midwest town, was the only American project for the MIPTV in development program at Cannes. So perhaps we'll be hearing more about that soon. So that's Jen's life. Jen?
That's it. That's everything. You got it.
Nothing else. So could you tell us a little bit about why you decided to select today Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin?
Because I love it so much. And I have to tell you, I'm a little intimidated to be here because I am not at all a film critic. I'm a film watcher. I'm a filmmaker.
Film critics are just like, I mean, most of us are just faking it until we make it.
Well,
like, we don't really know what we're doing.
It feels very important, and I'm excited to be here. It's a film that stays with you.
Yes.
I mean, it stays with you.
Yeah.
The first time I saw it was when it came out in 2013. I watched it with my husband at home on the couch. The whole time, I just kept dropping my jaw and looking at him like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
It's incredible and amazing and confounding and problematic, as I realized on rewatch this morning. But it's incredible, masterful filmmaking. Whether you agree with what it says or not is one thing, but you cannot ignore the fact that the director is in absolute control of everything and saying precisely what he wants to say.
So for those of you who haven't seen Under the Skin, today's episode is going to give you a lot of spoilers, but that should not stop you from listening before you watch. My motto as always is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Under the Skin first, this is your shot. So you're back, and let's introduce Under the Skin. Written by Walter Campbell and Jonathan Glazer and directed by Glazer for release in 2013, Under the Skin stars Scarlett Johansson as an alien come to Earth, assuming human form. We open with a man pulling a woman's body into a passenger van, and Scarlett's nameless woman then donning the clothes pulled from the woman on the road. All dressed, the woman begins driving the van around Scotland. She picks up a man and takes him to a dilapidated house, and this is how I try to explain it, because I'm like, how do you explain this? When inside, she begins stripping and walking across a black floor. The man follows her, but the floor seems to be made of a kind of tar now, and he begins sinking into a liquid abyss. The woman ventures out again. She's already left this guy. The woman ventures out to a rainy beach and tries to pick up a swimmer this time.
Do you know if there's any good spots to surf around here?
I'm not a surfer. Just living in a little tent over there.
She's interrupted by a couple screaming for help from the water. The swimmer goes in to rescue them. When he's recovering on the beach, the woman hits him and drags him back to her van, not caring about the humans at all. Seemingly, however, there's also some people on motorcycles who are cleaning up after this woman's exploits. It's a very strange thing that's happening. Now the woman picks up a man at a nightclub.
I saw you on the road.
You saw me on the road?
Earlier, yeah.
You're having a laugh, really? You saw me? You want to go and get a drink and a dance?
You alone here?
Yeah, I'm all alone, aren't I?
And this man also returns to the home and sinks through the abyss. We see below the surface for the first time now, and we see that these men are floating there, bloated and held captive in this place. The woman then seduces a man with facial disfigurement, played by Adam Pearson. But when she sees herself in a mirror, she lets the man go. The motorcyclists then abduct the man anyway, but they also go after the woman, as she's apparently gone rogue. On the run, the woman meets a kind man. At his house, the two begin to kiss, and the woman becomes aware of her new genitals for the first time. It frightens the shit out of her, and she runs again, this time into the forest, where she meets a logger. The logger tries to rape her, but she runs, and the logger begins tearing off her skin. As this happens, the logger sets the woman on fire, and we are left with an image of a being writhing in agony on the forest floor. So,
it makes no sense when you listen to it that way.
It doesn't. It really doesn't.
So one thing I wanted to mention was the very first shot of the movie is actually, it's a black frame with no sound, which drives me fucking crazy because when filmmakers do that, all I do is fiddle with my remote and figure out what's wrong with the television.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to get around that. But anyway, so that's what happens. Then the sound comes on, and it's still a black frame. And then all of a sudden, this little white prick of light in the middle of the screen grows. It's as the whole film is. It's completely mesmerizing. The thing that I love about this film, and one of the things that I love about all films that I find attractive, are the director is in complete control. You can relax. You know you're in safe hands. You're going to get told what you're going to get told when the director decides you need to know it.
Yes.
And that's extremely pleasing.
I think we should talk about how this movie came into being and how this control developed, because Glazer had been working on this for about 10 years, maybe 12, I think, when this came out. He was writing it before he did Birth, which is a movie that we've already talked about. He's not directed many movies, only three, if I can remember. And there's like an untitled project that's coming out. We've already talked about Birth on this show. So clearly Jonathan Glazer is doing something good if we're running through his almost entire filmography. But, you know, he'd been working on this with another writer, and they were doing an adaptation of a book, and they were doing a very close adaptation of the book. And so Jonathan Glazer, after that draft, he abandoned it because he said he didn't want to do a close one. He wanted to start over. So instead, he went, found another writer, William Campbell, who's been with him for a lot of years doing commercial work, which, you know, we're also going to get into. Jen does commercial work, too. And so what they did is William Campbell never read the book at all. He just talked to Jonathan Glazer about Jonathan Glazer's favorite parts.
Amazing. That's why it's the director's film.
It's a fantastic, what you would call a quote unquote true adaptation, and that's what the author of the novel said too. And he was so excited that they, you know, they adapted. They didn't just try to put it on screen.
Way to take a book and turn it into a movie, because books are really hard to turn into film. There's too much material there. So what they did in that process, the writer asking the director, tell me the book,
yes,
rather than the writer reading the book, it was already an adaptation. That was a process of adapting.
Yeah.
That was a process of the director saying, this is my vision. This is the version of the book that I want to make into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited that you started the conversation in this way, because something that's super clear to me watching this movie, and any movie, but very much this movie, is something that I believe very strongly, which is process dictates product.
Okay.
And, you know, when we talk about it, I don't think a film like this could get made in the States.
I believe that would be an uphill battle.
Yes, that's a better way to put it.
Because, I mean, you might be able to do it. You would do it for a lot less money.
But could you get those images and what you need and the talent?
I mean, they had to develop a new camera for this film.
That, yeah.
They made a new kind of camera that was small but had high resolution.
It's incredible.
You know, because it was all hidden camera.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm not sure if you would. And the time that he took to develop it, you know, this is a very patient filmmaker who,
yes,
knew that this is a story that he wanted to tell. How long is it? How long is the longest project that has taken you?
Okay, so that's what I was going to say. By the way, if you watch this movie and you buy it, don't just rent it, buy it, because the extras are incredible.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they talk about, just offhand, they were talking about scouting the locations for the final scenes in the woods.
Yes.
And I kind of laughed and cried because they had as much time to scout for that one location,
yep,
as I have for, like, my whole movies.
Yep.
Start to finish.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you're, like, making lower budget or independent films here, you've got usually 19, 20 days max.
That's right.
And that's, you know, shooting, like, maybe the first act of a movie in Europe.
Yeah, and that's why our movies are different.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
But you can see how, and that's interesting to me, too, because that goes back to the business and the financing and all those interesting things that come together when a movie gets made.
Mm-hmm.
It everything has an impact. Everything ends up on the screen in some way.
I think that when we're talking about this movie, and we should talk about point of view, because even though the cameras are, you know, they're not coming from Scarlett Johansson's point of view.
Right.
We're not sitting. It's everything is like on her.
Right.
But at the same time, we still feel like we're seeing the world from her eyes.
Absolutely.
And that's a really interesting way of, like, where they decided to place the cameras.
I think it has a lot to do with sound.
Okay, so tell me more about this. Why do you
the sound design, the score is incredible. And by the way, I wanted to mention those people. I don't know if you mentioned them in the open, but the score is by Micah Levy and the sound design by Johnny Byrne.
Yeah, Micah Levy is one of the best, and she also did my favorite score for Jackie a couple years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Really wonderful score as well.
The thing is, score can sound. I love sound design and score because it's like the one sneaky thing that filmmakers still have. I feel like audiences get visuals. You know, audiences are now born with cameras in their hands and they understand visuals and what's happening with visuals. But sound is sneaky and it's highly emotional. It's highly subjective. It also can manipulate your vision. It can manipulate what you're seeing,
mm-hmm,
where you look on the frame, how you receive that information. It can slow or speed time. All of those are very important tools for a filmmaker. And this film, those tools are used very masterfully.
It's one of those things when Jonathan Glazer had the idea that they would do all of the sound design and editing and the score all in the same house together for many, many months.
I love that.
But the thing is that they weren't able to all get in the same house, but they were all within a square, essentially like a square kilometer of each other.
See, but again, that goes back to process.
Yeah.
Ends up with product.
So what ended up happening is those three sections, those, you know, three, you know, people, the editor with Jonathan Glazer, he would go in between both of them, all of them, the score, the sound design, and they would continually shift.
Yep.
So there was no one person working on their own. The edit would change if the score was changing. The sound design would change if the edit and the score had changed. And it was just a constant for 8 months.
It's a genius and maddening way to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally not traditional, not Hollywood style.
So I want you to tell me a little bit more about how you work and how you've accomplished these kinds of things in your films then.
Well, that's generous to say that I've accomplished these kinds of things. I can't say that I have, but that's awesome. I work very fast, and I like working very fast. It doesn't give me time to worry and second guess myself. So let's see, Kelly and Cal, it's hard to remember, but we shot that, I think, in August. I believe the whole process from meeting the producers, so that was after the script was finished,
mm-hmm.
right? But so a year on the script with the writer, met the producers, and I am pretty sure a year and a half later we were on screen,
mm-hmm.
which I felt was a maddeningly long period of time and have since learned that I was very spoiled and
yeah.
need
and
to be
was
more
actually
grateful.
Pretty quick, yeah.
and then my second one, Rust Creek, which is coming out in January,
mm-hmm.
I pitched on it because I was a director for hire job.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain to people what that might be, just
yeah.
for the listeners?
Yeah. So the way I work, and this goes back to me trying desperately not to write because it bores me, is I will either pitch on a existing project, which means normally the producer has a piece of material in some form.
Mm-hmm.
They own the rights to a book, they have a script, whatever. I will go in and essentially do a job interview, and I will say, here's my interpretation, here's why I love it, please pick me, it'll be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much how it is. And most of the time you do not get hired, and sometimes you do. Then you get to make a movie. The other way is I will work as my own development producer, meaning I will do that work of that producer, which is finding the material or developing the material, which means working with a writer to hone the material in the direction that you want it to go. Probably like what Jonathan did with
his
writer from this book.
I think that's where I feel like that's the territory of the discussion that we're getting into.
Yeah.
It's just like, how do you develop a project when you're guiding it more than you are necessarily writing it?
It's a hard thing for me to answer because that's what I've always done. So, I mean, basically, to break it down very simply, depending on how early you're starting, like they did with this book, he said, here's the idea, here's what I like, okay, go write it, go, come back, I read it, I give notes.
Mm-hmm.
And that process continues until we get to something that we're happy with. And then you test it on people to make sure that it is as you believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're sure about that, you try to set it up, which means you take it to producers, you take it to financiers, and then you get to make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how my first one happened.
Okay. But and that one was your developing producer, and then the second one is director for hire.
Yes.
What kinds of notes are you giving, though? Like, what do you... Because I've been trying to research, you know, how Jonathan Glazer works with William Campbell, because
right.
they've had such a long relationship together. I think they're working together on the next one,
That's
too.
That's so cool.
And, you know... William Campbell was writing for him for commercials, you know, and music videos.
So that's super weird and highly unusual. I wonder if that's because they're working in Europe.
I guarantee it.
Yeah.
I think it's just a different
Yeah, it's
system.
A totally different system. But that's awesome. And that's why their stuff looks the way it does. When I give notes, I try to give notes in a very basic form, which is, this is what I received. This is what I thought you were trying to send. What do we want to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to align those? Do we want to change those? And how do we do that?
Yes.
And that process just happens over and over and over and over again until you have fewer notes. You always have notes.
Oh, that sounds easy.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, I would love to get into some of the more feminist aspects of this film, or how people see them or what they are.
Yeah.
And also, you know, how to commit a lasting image to film. Thanks, and we'll be right back.
Fairhaven's a city in a bubble. An actual bubble. It keeps the monsters out. Most of them, anyway.
I never liked the look of movies on Blu-ray. For my money, Betamax is the superior format.
I'm thinking of deleting Facebook and going back to MySpace.
As far as beverages go, I'm just kind of over water.
Though I guess at any given party, you're gonna meet some dudes like that, even if you're not in the middle of a nightmarish wasteland. Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jen McGowan, and we're talking about Under the Skin. So,
yes,
when I first saw this movie,
what did you think?
I was watching it with a friend of mine, like another ultra feminist friend of mine, and my husband. And my husband got something different out of this, but my female friend and I, we were like, oh my God, this is about the horrors of female sexuality and being a woman in the world. And my husband was just like, oh, really?
That's so funny. Yes. So I think this is one of those films that you can't watch and not have your gender contribute to how you receive the film.
Yeah.
It's, and, you know, on second viewing, I find it starting to be problematic at the last third of the film. And I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, my God, I love this film. Am I a bad feminist? Ah.
No, I to me, I think I guess I just don't find it as I feel like it's more honest towards the end, because I feel like in my head, it feels like she's got this new body. She realizes that she has some kind of sexuality.
Yes.
And that's the thing that scares her and the thing that finally makes, like, she had power until she came into sexuality, which is, I think, something that happens
and
to women.
And she gets destroyed for it.
Yeah. And that, to me, it seems an honest interpretation of the way that I have looked at the world in my life.
I don't disagree that it's quite
true.
Factual.
Yeah.
I just don't know if it's okay. I mean, no, I know it's not okay. I don't know if it's okay to like the movie. I don't know. Whatever.
I feel like it's cathartic, you know, like where I'm just like, yes, this is what it's like. The second that you reveal yourself, you know, like you're stripped of your power. And
well, that's why I feel like, and I've said this before in other places, but I feel like the sexual revolution missed something in the 70s. We didn't need more sex. We've always had sex from the beginning of time. We need pleasure. And that's what this is about. She feels pleasure.
You can quote Jen on this.
She the moment she experienced pleasure, she was punished.
Yeah. It's a trope that we see quite often in genre films.
I would have loved to have seen this whole film if Jonathan were a woman. The same process, but I would have liked to have known if anything would have been different. I thought of small things that would have been different. Like, for example, when Scarlett, by the way, kudos to her for doing this film, because
she was signed on for 10 years before she became a megastar.
Fucking amazing of her to do this movie.
Yeah.
You know, movies do not get made without talent signing on.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh, she says to the one guy, don't you miss being with a girl?
So you never think about it then?
Think about what?
Being with a girl.
And I was like, the word girl really bothered me in that sentence. She's a grown woman.
But I don't know that she knows it.
True, but I don't think the word should have been given any weight, but what she's asking is, don't you miss having sex?
Yeah.
With a girl?
Yeah.
No, that's not okay.
But I feel like the way that I interpret that is that you have this being who's not feminine or masculine, who inhabits a feminine body, and there's a whole sequence where you have, for instance, Scarlett Johansson's learning the accent, you know, so you're hearing her learn the accent.
Amazing.
And so to me, it feels like this is a person who's picking up on the way that the world works. And like, this is how I manipulate people. These are the things that people expect to hear. And so when I hear something like that, I guess I just consider it part of like, well, yeah, you're mimicking the world that you come into to try to manipulate these men.
I wonder if that one was intentional or an accident. I don't know.
I can't tell. But I think that we should mention that the script for this was 50 pages long.
I love that you know all this awesome stuff, because I didn't know that.
That's amazing. So the script for this is 50 pages long. It did not start out 50 pages long. It was much longer. And there was a lot of dialogue written.
Really?
Yeah. And so what they ended up doing was, what that dialogue did is it served a different kind of purpose. It helped the actors understand what they were doing. It helped the financiers understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
And the crew, the grip, the camera, everyone understood. And then they took the dialogue out.
That's amazing.
So it was more of an overwriting And then once you get to set, you know, he's going to trust his instinct. But we all know we're on the same page and the beats that we need to hit.
It's funny. I was speaking to a filmmaker about that, something similar yesterday, which is the way that I work is I have a shot list, but it's very important for me to remind myself what the meaning of each shot is.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're shooting, everything goes to shit, basically.
And
you don't get all your shots and a tornado comes and all these things happen.
Yeah.
So my touchstone is always going back to this document that I have that is, what is a shot? What is a shot supposed to mean? What is it supposed to do? So that way, if I lose that exact shot, mm-hmm. I can still maintain the meaning somewhere.
Yeah,
because
like maybe you can replicate something like quicker that has a similar meaning.
Yeah, because all film is it's a means of communication.
Mm-hmm.
It's pictures and sound over time. You know, it changes.
God, you make it sound so simple.
But it is. And actually, this movie, and I think this is one of the things I love about it. Its concept is actually incredibly simple.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so pleasing to me. I believe very strongly you do one thing with one movie, one thing at a time. You don't say your whole, this is everything I believe in the world, here's one movie. You pick one thing and you do that amazingly well. And this is a film that does that.
I think we should get into the idea of shooting with hidden camera. They had 8 to 10 cameras running.
Yeah. Okay.
Simultaneously.
So here's another kudos to Scarlett Johansson, by the way, because there's improv in this. She's doing an accent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not common to her. And she's improvising with non-actors.
Yes.
That's really putting herself out on the line. This could have sucked.
Yeah. And she's already a very famous person at this point.
Yeah. She's risking a lot to do this film, and she's incredible in it. So they're improvising with non-actors. The cameras are hidden. I guess I've done some hidden camera in like commercial stuff, but that's not as a director. I've never really worked with hidden cameras. So what that tells me is they were making a lot of wishful decisions in the prep,
mm-hmm.
and actual decisions in the edit.
Yeah. The edit took forever.
I'm sure.
And the edit was actually guided by a lot of whoever signed the paper.
Yes, I thought that totally, because there's tons of crowd scenes,
yeah.
and they're regular people. They're not actors. So the way they would have had to have done this,
yes.
as far as I can imagine,
yes.
is they're shooting and some poor little PA is having to run around following the camera, getting signatures of everybody that appeared in frame.
That's literally, they would jump out from behind trash
and
cans.
Go, surprise, and we're on
with
camera.
Like with a piece of paper and just be like, sign it now. And then people like... So Jonathan Glazer would be watching from, you know, multiple monitors from
like
a nearby,
a
nearby video village, which might have been in a van, I think, that they had following her. Because they also had a security guard in a van following her just in case. And he was freaked out. He was like, oh, God, please, no one touch Scarlett Johansson.
She's expensive.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's watching it and he would see this really beautiful interaction. And he said about 65% of the time that beautiful interaction wouldn't make it into the film because they couldn't
allowed.
Get them to sign.
Yeah, yeah. I have no doubt.
So, you know, he had like a little bit of heartbreak. But yes. So, in fact, the edit was difficult, but it was also guided by at least those parameters.
Sure. Structure. You know, he had goals and intentions and clear a clear point of view and filtered everything through that lens.
I think I would like to get into the idea of emotion and aesthetics.
Okay.
This. Because people have talked to him, you know, like Glazer has a specific look for his films, but we're not talking about a look like a Wes Anderson look. You know what I mean?
No.
Like it's a different kind of look. When I see his films, I can recognize that they're his, but it's different. And so he said, quote, about aesthetics, that it has to follow the atmosphere. The first thing you're trying to do is create a world, and the aesthetic is a component in how you do that. But I don't think aesthetics should lead anything, because then it's like you're retrofitting something. The aesthetics have to have to flower to form the essence of what you're trying to do.
Yes.
Like the aesthetic of birth, for instance, in my mind, needed to be this kind of porcelain muted palette. I wanted the images to be photographically exceptional and quite formalist, and still with volcanic emotions happening within those frames, rather to those frames. And that all came from the emotional center of the piece. Likewise, with Under the Skin, the emotional center of the piece here was really about how to put her in the world, in disguise, so that we could be undetectable doing so. We wanted to film people close up without their knowledge and have them interact with her without their knowing that they're interacting with a character in the film. Everything had to serve that. So what does that mean
Absolutely.
To you?
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. What that means to me is form follows function.
Okay.
And that, to me, is what is so exciting about directing other people's scripts.
Okay.
You
tell me about
it. A script and you say, what is the essence of this? How do I distill this into the thing that I want to say? Mm-hmm. How do I find the angle or highlight this material in a particular way that says the one thing that I'm happy to spend my life on for 2 years, 10 years, whatever? And then everything from that point on serves that.
How have you done that in your work?
Well, I don't know that I have been successful, but I can tell you that I've tried to do that.
Well, tell me how you approached it for Rust Creek.
So for Rust Creek, I always answer what is a film about in two ways. There's what is a film about, what's the plot?
Sure.
And there's what is a film about, what's the meaning?
Yeah.
So what is a film about? It's about a young woman in her last year of college in Kentucky who gets a job interview in D.C. over Thanksgiving break. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to let anybody know she has it in case she doesn't secure the job. So she kind of covers her tracks. She has to drive through Appalachia to get there and shit goes down.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the plot. What is it about and what made me excited about the script is I look at that story and I say, this is about a young woman who thinks the only thing she has to do to be an adult is get a job. But actually, she needs to take down the whole fucking patriarchy.
Yeah.
And that's exciting and interesting to me. So every decision that you make when you're making that film comes back to, are we reinforcing this or are we showing another angle of this? So, for example, this is a small thing and probably nobody in the world notices it. But as an example of how a decision gets made, to me, that told me that her worldview was going from a more black and white worldview to a more diverse grade worldview.
Yeah.
So we illustrated that very literally in the color timing at the end of the film.
Yeah.
We went from more saturated to less saturated. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a small little detail, one little thing. Like I said, probably nobody's going to notice. But you do that over and over and over with every decision you make in every single frame, 24 frames a second for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And he does this, Jonathan Glazer does this in Under the Skin exceedingly well.
Yeah.
Mostly because he has time to think about every single little detail.
Let's actually talk about time. Because I think that this is something that really struck me was the fact that he was saying that he felt like he has the freedom to fail in a way that other people don't. He said, quote, making this film is like the highest wire I've walked on, but the most exciting. It's liberating. That's what it is. I loved it. I loved the fear of it. And the other thing is that I was supported by people who were perfectly happy for me to fail. Not happy for me to fail, but it was like, we know we might fail, but let's just go for it. And the freedom that gives you, I've never felt so supported before. I think that might be why I pushed as far as I did.
Absolutely.
So to me, I think that kind of gets at what you're saying, that, you know, he has the time and he quite clearly has the mentality that I'm going to do what I can do and I'm going to be as weird as I can, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But not, and as he said earlier, not weird for weird's sake.
No.
He was trying to say a specific thing.
Yeah. Going into the depths of his imagination to do this.
Yes.
But that's not what we have in the States, and it's not what you have for independent filmmakers, and it's not what we have for women and people of color.
That's right. And that's why we don't produce films like this.
Oh, but my God, wouldn't it be wonderful if we
did? It would be amazing.
So we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to do a little talk on Scarlett Johansson, kind of give an appreciation there, but also discuss why she was probably the best person to play this role. We'll be right back.
I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the hosts of
Everything's Coming Up, Simpsons.
Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D minus, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
Homer wearing that golf outfit is so funny. And then there's, when he gets super into golf, he's wearing the golf hat in bed.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, yeah. That's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point have been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, smell you later.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Jen McGowan. We're talking about Under the Skin. I would love to talk about Jonathan Glazer's approach to Scarlett Johansson and the kind of meta commentary that he's making having cast her in this film.
Yes.
So I'm going to give you a little quote. And this is essentially about this movie being more about women desexualizing themselves.
Yep.
That's the way he thinks. He says, quote, "Well, it wasn't meant to be a cautionary tale about sexuality. I think the female sexuality in the film is something which is objectified. The creature that Scarlett plays in the film exists to be objectified. She's there to be objectified. And what she does in the course of the film in her own discovery is she reclaims that. She de-eroticizes her own image, actually. Thinking about that now, that's nothing that I would worry about. It seems to me to be somehow in line with Scarlett's life as an actress and in the way she's objectified. There's a parallel idea of her reclaiming her image and her sexuality in this film, which I think she does." So it gets a little muddled there. We have to remember that this was a time right after Scarlett Johansson's nude photos were stolen. And that was when it came out, the two people who took her photos were prosecuted and now are in jail for leaking her image.
Do you remember, did those photos come out when this movie came out or when this movie was being made?
When it was being made.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think it was before it was being made.
Oh, that's a lot for my head to comprehend in one moment. But
I mean, it's a heavy, big idea. But I have a lot of quotes about him talking about this.
I'm not sure if I agree with him either.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, like, it's definitely up for interpretation. But yeah. This is clearly something he's going for because
he and that's clear that was intended in the movie. But there's interesting moments. Like, okay. First of all, you cast the sexiest woman in the world in a movie like this.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying something.
Yeah.
You then shoot her naked in a very oddly unsexy way.
Yeah, she's naked and scary.
I was like, oh, there's so much to unpack there. And God, I hope she wouldn't hear this and take offense, but like, I was so happy that when they show her naked, she's not like sucking in her tummy.
No.
You know, she looks... for a perfect human. She looks normal.
Yeah.
I did find the way she held her foot very demurely interesting and at odds with what he is saying there. I know that's a super small detail, but when everything is saying the same thing.
Explain that because, you know, people haven't seen the movie.
Right.
Like, what do you mean with this?
So when she when she first is naked, she's getting clothes. But when we first see her draw the man to her, which
yeah, into
we
the abyss.
Presume is sexual, at least for the man.
Yeah.
She stands there quite dead on, naked, in what I believe is a very natural pose, and that she's not, you know, withholding and trying to look thin and stand up perfectly or whatever, except for her left leg. It's pitched in and her knee is bent and she's standing, she's resting, you know, on her tippy toe in a very demure.
Oh, that is a demure. That's not something that I noticed when I watched it the last
time. It stood out to me quite a lot, and it does every time I see it because it's at odds with what I believe is supposed to be being said in that moment.
Yeah.
So it screamed at me.
When you were working with your actress for Rust Creek, were there any things that you had to give, you know, feedback, like readjust?
Oh, always, her? Constantly. Constantly.
Anything you can share?
Yeah. I mean, that's by the way, that's not criticism. That's creation.
Yeah.
That's, that is the work. And that's what's so exciting and fun. Anything I can share? I mean, it's just always constant. You want to let the actor know that.
Well, because she's got fight scenes in this. Like,
yeah.
she has to fight.
Yeah.
And there's parallels, I would say, between Under the Skin and Rust Creek, aside from, you know, there's them being in the woods and being kind of pursued by someone,
yeah.
which has parallels with the ending, I would say, with Under the Skin. But you have a woman who is unexpectedly stronger without explanation than you think that she's going to be, you know?
Right.
And in your film, it's someone who can actually maybe fight back a little bit.
It's funny because I think when I see Rust Creek, and I know what you're talking about, I don't think it's unexpected because I don't know about you, but every young girl that I know took some sort of self-defense class.
Yeah.
You're not really seeing anything there that is like kung fu, you know?
Yeah.
It's in the world of what we live. It's like when you see a woman on screen carrying her keys between her knuckles.
Yeah.
Everyone recognizes that. Women do, at least.
Yeah. That's something that the alien Scarlett Johansson wouldn't recognize.
No, but there's one moment in the movie. So, oh, God, I love this movie. There's one moment in the movie when she is driving. She's parked in a parking lot and these little gang of men.
Yep. It's the turning point in the film, I think.
Yes.
The emotional turning point where you're like, you realize that she is not always the one in power.
It drips, though. It mm-hmm. evolves. The first drip is when she gets the rose from the rose cellar and there's blood.
Yeah.
To me, that's the first drip. I could have missed something. But anyway, she's sitting there completely unperturbed, is the best way I can describe it, by these men banging on her car window, on the front window of the windshield.
Yeah.
Something that would be terrifying to a normal human single woman.
Yeah.
Totally unperturbed. And then there's a flash, a flicker of maybe fear in her eyes.
Yeah.
And she just drives off. Not in a hurry, not in a squeal.
Yeah, she's like, oh, no,
off.
I don't like this.
I don't like this. And she takes action and she goes away.
Yeah.
Her power, the power shifted for her. She was no longer in control. She felt something. For me, this film is also really an exploration of humanity.
Yeah.
It's like, how do we see an alien becoming human, but specifically a human woman. And what does that mean?
One of the things that I love is, you know, he dabbles in genre, obviously. You know, he's interested in genre. Birth is like a pseudo-genre. You know, I don't want to give people, you know, listen to that episode, definitely. But it's, you know, and Sexy Beast is a crime film. This is science fiction.
Yeah.
But the way that he thinks about genre is really different. And he wants to use genre for its tropes, which make it easier to tell his story, which I think is a wonderful thing and something that more people should do because, you know, genre does have really good tropes.
Yeah.
And it gives you a shortcut. So, for instance, you know, you have that opening scene that you were describing earlier where you have the little dot that grows. And a lot of people, I think,
that's like a sci-fi film.
It is. And because we have that understanding of,
yes.
you know, from, you know, so many films before it. And the one I'm thinking about specifically is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the mm-hmm. 1970s version, where you understand that something is coming in from outer space
yes.
because you've seen a similar image, and then you get to go and tell your story.
But that's what's so amazing about making movies, is you are communicating. You're communicating with the
yeah.
audience. So in order to communicate with an audience, you need to understand what their lexicon is.
Yeah.
In order to use that language clearly. And that's why sometimes movies don't travel across cultures.
Yeah.
You're speaking different language, literally.
Yeah. But one of the things, I mean, I've written a little bit about this lately for some pieces in 2019. But, you know, genre films are the few that do travel because...
Common language.
Yeah, because we do have a visual common language.
Common visual language, to
yeah,
be clear.
About science fiction, about action, and about horror and fantasy. Those ones specifically, you know, those are...
Yeah.
Those travel so that we can... you know, we can experience other people's fear. We can experience other people's, you know, paranoia or anxiety through science fiction. And that's just a wonderful thing to use, you know, genre for these tropes. And I applaud Jonathan Glazer for getting what he can out of genre, even though he's like, you know, after he made it, he was just like, we made like a tragic drama, right?
I mean, that goes back to having an intention is a must. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what people are going to see when it appears.
Yeah, you have no idea what this. I think that we should get into just a little bit more about Scarlett inhabiting this character, because I do think it's interesting that Jonathan Glazer was watching Scarlett Johansson with her dialogue coach learning how to speak in a British accent.
Oh, that's really
smart. Came in just to see her, and he was just like,
that's the movie.
Can you guys hold on for 1 second? And he came back with one of the cameras that they had developed,
smart.
The one camera, and started filming her and getting all this great sound. And so he is literally capturing her learning how to speak in a British accent, becoming a human, you know, becoming British as the character is learning to become a human.
That's brilliant.
And so then you get these very so it's serendipitous the kind of words that you get, because these are words that her dialogue coach was just like uses to teach her dialogue.
But it's so perfect, and he couldn't have intended that.
No.
That's the other thing that's really cool about filmmaking is once you set what you're doing, once you set what your perspective is, what your goal is, the world organizes itself for you.
Yeah, you're like a conspiracy theorist is the way that I think about
it.
When you're working on a larger process, you are connecting the dots. You're just like, you've got the board up and you're like, oh my God, and then that, and I envision this.
Yes,
and then,
yes. It's the most invigorating thing ever.
Yeah, so I love the fact that there are, you know, people were asking Jonathan Glazer specifically about the fact that Scarlett Johansson says the word film. And people were like, oh, what did you mean with that? And he's like, actually, it was just serendipitous. Because people had developed an entire idea of what they thought the movie was about because of the words she was saying.
Yes, it was serendipitous, but in post, he chose to keep it.
That's true. He did. Can we just for a second before we leave, can we talk about that infamous beach scene, which is a scene that I love with all of my heart? And
it's
heartbreaking
incredible.
And cruel.
It's so cruel. And it's brilliant. I don't know. It's awesome. The frame for me that encompasses the whole thing is she dragging the body in front of a wailing baby.
I think, okay, so let's make sure that we set up this scene for people just to remind them. Because she goes to try to get a guy who's on the beach and a swimmer. It's a very stormy day. And the waves are huge. Mm-hmm. They're crashing around.
The sound design again. The nature versus the alien world. Yeah. Yes.
And I should mention that the sound design, he said something really interesting about the sound design too. He said, if we stop for a second and become aware of the air conditioning unit, there's clicking going on down there.
Yes.
We block all that out. The role of this was to use all those things and have those things somehow becoming symphonic, just bubbling away in the background. All of the things you would normally cut out of the soundtrack for being noisy would be the things we used and pushed to the foreground. So he had hidden microphones all over the beach. They're all over the beach, microphones picking things up. And he decided that he wanted to shoot that scene as though it was a scene coming on the news, that you were just watching it from the news. Here's a tragedy that unfolds and, you know, we're breaking to it now. And
almost like a cyclorama or something.
Yeah. And, you know, he had two experienced open ocean swimmers who were drowning and needed to be
saved.
Really
rough.
There's a baby wailing, you know, and there's just so many things happening. But it is, as he said before, a very dispassionate scene.
So this is a really great scene. From the moment she is standing there watching the swimmer swim.
Yeah.
He comes out of the water. They have a little conversation. We know she's hunting him. He gets distracted by someone in the distance swimming.
Yes.
We see what he sees.
Yes.
We go back to him. Then we get more information. And this is the pulling. This is the lure. This is, I'm only feeding you breadcrumbs to take you where I want you to go.
Yeah.
We then see a man running into the ocean. So that tells us to interpret that person in the ocean now, not as a swimmer, but as a drowner.
Yeah.
And as that happens, they're watching, and Charlotte is watching it completely dispassionately.
Yeah.
And our swimmer starts running. And then, as you're saying, from the news perspective, but the way I saw it was I saw that dispassionate angle as her perspective.
Yes, exactly. That's one of what we get back to the thing that we were talking about earlier, where even though the camera's not positioned from her face.
No, and it wasn't even
still,
from her angle, by
no,
the way.
No, it's not.
But I knew it was her point of view.
It's an emotional factor, yeah.
Yes, and the sound is so enveloping, and it's weird because in that moment, the sound is quite emotional.
Yeah.
Because it's those slamming waves and you know someone is drowning.
Yeah.
But the camera is not involved.
Does this give you any kind of ideas, like rewatching this movie, like ways that you might approach like another film? Because he's doing some interesting stuff here, right? So even if you don't have the time to do things the way he's doing, having a dispassionate camera, for instance.
Totally. That's a decision you can make.
Right. Having action off of the screen.
Absolutely.
And having things, you know, signaled in that manner. Sound design being, you know.
Look, you try to do all of these things, but the difference is when you have one day to plan and execute versus when you have 8 months to plan and execute.
Yeah.
You might not do it as well.
I applaud any American filmmaker who is doing their part right now.
Seriously. It's tough out there.
It's tough. Jen, we can see your movie Rust Creek.
Yes.
Is it theaters?
It opens the first week of January in theaters and online.
So we can see it in the theaters or we can get it on VOD.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking today about this movie.
Thank
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Everyone, please see this movie.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Do you know if there's any good spots to surf around here?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.